that he was an aberration and didn't deserve to live. He went out to the shed with a rope. She said it in a too high voice, the way one does when one is trying very hard not to cry. He reached for her, and she let him take her in his arms. How old were you? He asked. 10, she said. John was 17. Tell me more about him, he coaxed. What was he like? Oh, you know, she mumbled. Kind, protective. John was the one who read to me every night, bandaged my skin knees, taught me how to read and write. We moved a lot, and I never really got any good at making friends, but I had John. We spent most of the time at the library. It became our sanctuary, the only thing we could count on from town to town. Sort of funny now that I think about it. What do you mean? Because my parents were in the sanctuary business? He nodded. One thing I've learned, Calvin, people will always yearn for a simple solution to their complicated problem. It's a lot easier to have faith in something you can't see, can't touch, can't explain, and can't change, rather than to have faith in something you actually can, she sighed. Oneself, I mean. She tensed her stomach. They lay silently, both wading in the misery of their pasts. Where are your parents now? Oh, my father's in prison. One of his signs from God ended up killing 3 people. As for my mother, she divorced, remarried, and moved to Brazil. No extradition laws there. Did I mention my parents never paid taxes? Calvin let loose a long, low whistle. When one is raised on a steady diet of sorrow, it's hard to imagine that others might have had an even larger serving. So, after your brother died, it was just you and your parents? No, she interrupted. Just me. My parents were often gone for weeks at a time, and without John I had to become self-sufficient, so I did. I taught myself to cook and do small house repairs. And school? I already told you, I went to the library. That's it? She turned toward him. That's it. They lay together like felled trees. From several blocks away, a church bell tolled. When I was a kid, Calvin said quietly, I used to tell myself every day was new, that anything could happen. She took his hand again. Did it help? His mouth sagged as he remembered what the bishop at the boys' home had revealed to him about his father. I guess I'm just saying we shouldn't let ourselves get stuck in the past. She nodded, imagining a newly orphaned boy trying to convince himself of a brighter future. That had to be a special brand of bravery, for a child to endure the worst and, despite every law in the universe and all evidence to the contrary, decide the next day might be better. Every day is new, Calvin repeated, as if he were still that child. But the memory of what he'd learned about his father still proved too much for him, and he stopped. Look, I'm tired. Let's call it a day. We should get some sleep, she said, not yawning. We can talk about this another time, he said, depressed. Maybe tomorrow, she lied. Chapter 6. The Hastings Cafeteria. There's nothing more irritating than witnessing someone else's unfair share of happiness. And to some of their colleagues at Hastings Research Institute, Elizabeth and Calvin had an unfair share. He, because he was brilliant. She, because she was beautiful. When they became a couple, their unfair shares automatically doubled, making it really unfair. The worst part, according to these people, was that they hadn't earned their shares. They'd simply been born that way, meaning their unfair share of happiness arose not from hard work, but from genetic luck. And the fact that the duo decided to combine their unearned gifts into one loving and probably highly sexual relationship, which the rest of them had to witness at lunch every day, just made it that much worse. Here they come, said a geologist from the 7th floor. Batman and Robin. I heard they're shacking up together. Did you know that? Asked his lab mate. Everyone knows that. I didn't know that, a third named Eddie said grimly. The 3 geologists watched as Elizabeth and Calvin chose an empty table in the middle of the cafeteria, the clash of trays and silverware rat-a-tat-tatting around them like gunfire. As the stink of cafeteria stroganoff threatened to asphyxiate the rest of the room, Calvin and Elizabeth placed a set of open Tupperware containers on the table. Chicken parmesan, au gratin potatoes, some sort of salad. Oh, I see, said one of the geologists. So the food here isn't good enough for them. My cat eats better than this, the other geologist said, shoving his tray away. Hi, fellas, chirped Miss Frask, a too cheerful, wide-bottomed secretary from personnel. Frask set down her tray, then cleared her throat as she waited for Eddie, a geology lab tech, to pull out her chair. Frask had been dating Eddie for 3 months, and while she would have liked to report it was all going very well, it wasn't. Eddie was immature with boorish tendencies. He chewed with his mouth open, guffawed at jokes that weren't funny, and said things like, va-va-voom. Still, Eddie had one important thing going for him. He was single. Well, thank you, Eddie, she said as he leaned over and yanked her chair out for her. So sweet. Proceed at your own risk, one of the geologists warned, tipping his head in Calvin and Elizabeth's general direction. Why, she said, what are we looking at? She spun in her chair to follow their gaze. Geez, Louise, she said, spying the happy couple. Again? The four of them watched in silence as Elizabeth pulled out a notebook and passed it to Calvin. Calvin studied the page, then made some comment. Elizabeth shook her head, then pointed at something specific. Calvin nodded and, cocking his head to the side, slowly started to chew his lips. He is so unattractive, Frask said in disgust. But because she was in personnel, and personnel never comments on an employee's physical appearance, she added, and by that I only mean blue is not his color. One of the geologists took a bite of stroganoff, then set down his fork in resignation. Hear the latest? Evans was nominated for the Nobel again. The whole table issued a collective sigh. Well, that's meaningless, one of the geologists said. Anyone can be nominated. Oh, really? Have you ever been nominated? They continued to watch, transfixed, as a few minutes later Elizabeth reached down and pulled out a package wrapped in wax paper. What do you think that is? One of the geologists asked. Baked goods, Eddie said, his voice filled with awe. She bakes, too. They watched as she offered Calvin brownies. Oh, good God, Frask said, exasperated. What do you mean, too? Anyone can bake. I don't understand her, one of the geologists said. She's got Evans. Why is she still here? He paused, as if weighing all possibilities. Unless, he said, Evans doesn't want to marry her. Why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free? The other geologist suggested. I grew up on a farm, Eddie contributed. Cows are a lot of work. Frask glanced at him sideways. It irritated her that he continued to crane his neck towards Zot like a plant to sunlight. I am a specialist in human behavior, she said. At one point, I was pursuing a PhD in psychology. She looked at her lunchmates, hoping they'd ask her about her academic aspirations, but no one seemed even slightly interested. Anyway, that's why I can say with confidence it's she who's using him. From across the room, Elizabeth straightened her papers, then rose. Sorry to cut this short, Calvin, but I have a meeting.
A meeting? Calvin said, as if she'd just announced she was attending an execution. If you worked in my lab, you'd never have to go to meetings.
But I don't work in your lab.
But you could.
She sighed, busying herself with the Tupperware. Of course she'd love to work in his lab, but it wasn't possible. She was an entry-level chemist. She had to make her own way. Try to understand, she'd told him more than once. But we live together. This is just the next logical step. When it came to Elizabeth, he knew logic ruled the day. That was an economic decision, she reminded him, which on the surface it was. Calvin had initiated the idea, saying that because they spent most of their free time together, it made financial sense to share living quarters. Still, it was also 1952, and in 1952, an unmarried woman did not move in with a man. So he was a bit surprised when Elizabeth didn't hesitate. I'll pay half, she'd said. She removed the pencil from her hair and tapped it on the table, awaiting his response. She hadn't actually meant she'd pay half. Paying half was impossible. Her paycheck hovered just above ridiculous. Half was out of the question. Anyway, the house was in his name. Only he would receive the tax benefit, therefore half wouldn't be fair. She'd give him a moment to do the math. Half was outrageous. Half, he mused, as if considering it. He already knew she couldn't pay half. She couldn't even pay a quarter.
This was because Hastings paid her a penurious wage, about half what a man in her position made, a fact he'd encountered in her personnel file, which he'd peeked at illegally. Anyway, he didn't have a mortgage. He'd paid off his tiny bungalow last year with the proceeds from a chemistry prize and had instantly regretted it. You know how people say, never put all your eggs in one basket? He had. Or, she'd said, brightening, perhaps we could work out a trade agreement, you know, like nations do. A trade? Rent for services rendered. Calvin froze. He'd overheard all the gossip regarding the free milk. Dinner, she said, 4 nights a week. And then before he could reply, she said, fine, 5. But that's my final offer. I'm a good cook, Calvin. Cooking is serious science. In fact, it's chemistry. So they'd moved in together, and it all worked out. But the lab idea, she refused to even consider it. You were just nominated for a Nobel, Calvin, she reminded him as she snapped the Tupperware lid closed on the remaining potatoes. Your third nomination in 5 years. I want to be judged on my own work, not work people think you did for me. Anyone who knows you would never think that. She burped the Tupperware, then turned to look at him. That's the problem. No one knows me. She'd felt this way her entire life. She'd been defined not by what she did, but by what others had done. In the past, she was either the offspring of an arsonist, the daughter of a serial wife, the sister of a hanged homosexual, or the graduate student of a renowned lecher. Now she was the girlfriend of a famous chemist, but she was never just Elizabeth Zott. And on those rare occasions when she wasn't defined by others' actions, then she was dismissed out of hand as either a lightweight or a gold digger based on the thing she hated most about herself, how she looked, which happened to be just like her father. He was the reason she didn't smile much anymore. Before becoming an evangelist, her father had wanted to be an actor. He had both the charisma and the teeth, the latter professionally capped. The only thing missing? Talent. So when it became clear that acting was out, he took his skills to revival tents where his fake smile sold people on the end of the world. That's why, at age 10, Elizabeth stopped smiling. The resemblance faded. It wasn't until Calvin Evans came along that her smile reemerged. The first time was that night at the theater when he'd vomited all over her dress. She hadn't recognized him at first, but when she did, and despite the mess, she bent over to get a better look at his face. Calvin Evans. True, she'd been a little rude to him after he'd been rude to her, the Beakers, but between the two of them, there'd been immediate, irresistible pull. Still working on that? She asked, pointing at a nearly empty container. No, he said. You eat it. You could use the extra fuel. Actually, he'd planned to eat it, but he was willing to forego the extra calories if only she would stay. Like Elizabeth, he'd never been much of a people person. In fact, it wasn't until he'd found rowing that he'd made any real kind of connection with others. Physical suffering, he'd long ago learned, bonds people in a way that everyday life can't. He still kept in contact with his 8 Cambridge teammates, had even seen one of them just last month when he'd been in New York for a conference. Foreseat. They still called one another by their seat names, had become a neurologist.
You have a what? Foreseat had said, surprised. A girlfriend? Well, good for you, Six, he said, slapping him on the back. About bloody time.
Calvin had nodded excitedly, explaining in detail Elizabeth's work and habits and laugh and everything else he loved about her. But in a more somber tone, he also explained that although he and Elizabeth spent all their free time together, they lived together, they ate together, they drove back and forth to work together, it didn't feel like enough. It wasn't that he couldn't function without her, he told Foreseat, but rather that he didn't see the point of functioning without her. I don't know what to call it, he'd confided following a full examination. Am I addicted to her? Am I dependent in some sick sort of way? Could I have a brain tumor?
Jesus, Six, it's called happiness, Foreseat explained. When's the wedding?
But that was the problem. Elizabeth had made it clear that she had no interest in getting married. It's not that I disapprove of marriage, Calvin, she'd told him more than once, although I do disapprove of all the people who disapprove of us for not being married, don't you?
I do, Calvin agreed, thinking how much he would like to say those words to her in front of an altar. But when she looked at him expecting more, he added quickly, I do think we're lucky.
And then she smiled at him so earnestly that something inside his brain went haywire. As soon as they parted, he drove to a local jeweler, scanning the selections until he found the biggest small diamond he could afford. Sick with excitement, he kept the tiny box in his pocket for 3 months, waiting for exactly the right moment. Calvin, Elizabeth said, gathering the last of her things from the cafeteria table. Are you listening? I said I'm going to a wedding tomorrow. Actually, I'm in the wedding, if you can believe that. She gave a nervous shrug. So we should probably discuss that acid study tonight, if that works. Who's getting married?
My friend Margaret, the physics secretary. Well, that's who I'm meeting in 15 minutes, for a fitting.
Wait, you have a friend?
He thought Elizabeth only had workmates, fellow scientists who recognized her skill and undermined her results. Elizabeth felt a flush of embarrassment.
Well, yes, she said awkwardly. Margaret and I nod to each other in the hallways. We've spoken several times at the coffee urn.
Calvin willed his face to look as if this were a reasonable description of a friendship.
It's very last minute. One of her bridesmaids is sick, and Margaret said it's important to have an even ratio of bridesmaids to ushers.
Although as soon as she said it, she realized what Margaret really needed, a size 6 without weekend plans.
The truth was, she wasn't good at making friends. She told herself it was because she'd moved so much, had bad parents, lost her brother, but she knew others had experienced hardships, and they didn't have this issue. If anything, some of them seemed better at making friends, as if the specter of constant change or profound sorrow had revealed to them the importance of making connections wherever and whenever they landed. What was wrong with her? And then there was the illogical art of female friendship itself, the way it seemed to demand an ability to both keep and reveal secrets using precise timing. Whenever she moved to a new town, girls would take her aside at Sunday school and breathlessly confide their crushes on certain boys. She listened to their confessions, faithfully promising she would never tell, and she didn't. Which was all wrong, because it turned out she was supposed to tell. Her job as confidant was to break that confidence by telling boy X that girl Y thought he was cute, thus initiating a chain reaction of interest between the two parties. Why don't you just tell him yourself? She'd say to these would-be friends. He is right there. The girls would draw back in horror.
Elizabeth, Calvin said.
Elizabeth?
He leaned over the table and tapped her hand.
Sorry, he said as she startled. I think I lost you there for a moment. Anyway, I was just saying, I love weddings. I'll go with you.
Actually, he hated weddings. For years, they'd reminded him that he was still unloved. But now he had her, and tomorrow she'd be in close proximity to an altar, and he hypothesized such proximity could revise her perception of marriage. This theory even had a scientific name, associative interference.
No, she said quickly, I don't have an extra invite, and besides, the fewer people who see me in this dress, the better.
Come on, he said, reaching one long arm across the span that separated them, pulling her back down. Margaret can't expect you to go alone. And as for the dress, I'm sure it's not that bad.
Oh, no, it is, she said, reverting to her sensible tone of scientific certainty. Bridesmaids' dresses are designed to make the women in them look unappealing. That way, the bride looks better than usual. It's an accepted practice, a basic defensive strategy with biological roots. You see this sort of thing in nature all the time.
Calvin thought back to the weddings he'd attended and realized she might be right. Not once had he ever had the urge to ask a bridesmaid to dance. Could a dress really have that much power? He looked across the table at Elizabeth, her firm hands moving through space as she described the gown. Extra padding at the hips, sloppy gathering at the waist and chest, fat bow spanning the buttocks. He thought about the people who designed these dresses, how, like bomb manufacturers or pornography stars, they had to remain vague about the way they made their livings.
Well, it's nice of you to help out, but I thought you didn't like weddings.
No, it's only marriage I don't like. We've talked about it, Calvin. You know where I stand. But I'm happy for Margaret. Mostly.
Mostly?
Well, she said, she keeps repeating how by Saturday night she'll finally be Mrs. Peter Dickman, as if changing her name is the finish line for a race she's been in since she was six.
She's marrying Dickman, he said, from cellular biology?
He didn't like Dickman. Exactly, she said. I've never understood when women marry. They're expected to trade their old names like used cars, losing their last and sometimes even their first. Mrs. John Adams? Mrs. Abe Lincoln? As if their previous identities had just been 20-odd year placeholders before they became actual people. Mrs. Peter Dickman. It's a life sentence.
Elizabeth Evans, on the other hand, Calvin thought to himself, was perfect. Before he could stop himself, he felt around in his pocket for the small blue box and without hesitation placed it in front of her. Maybe this could help improve the dress, he said, his heart at full gallop.
Ring box, announced one of the geologists. Brace yourself, kids. Engagement in progress.
But there was something about Elizabeth's face that didn't read right. Elizabeth looked down at the box and then looked back up at Calvin, her eyes wide with terror.
I know your position on marriage, Calvin said in a rush, but I've been giving it a lot of thought, and I think you and I would have a different kind of marriage. It would be very unaverage, fun even.
Calvin, there are also practical reasons to get married. Lower taxes, for instance.
Calvin,
at least look at the ring, he begged. I've been carrying it around for months, please.
I can't, she said, looking away. It'll just make it harder to say no.
Her mother had always insisted that the measure of a woman was how well she married.
I could have married Billy Graham, she'd often claimed. Don't think he wasn't interested. By the way, Elizabeth, when you do get engaged, insist on the biggest rock possible. That way, if the marriage doesn't work out, you can hawk it.
As it turned out, her mother was speaking from experience. When her parents filed for divorce, it was revealed she'd been married three times before.
I'm not going to marry, Elizabeth told her. I'm going to be a scientist. Successful women scientists don't marry.
Oh, really? Her mother laughed. I see. So you think you're going to marry your work like nuns marry Jesus? Although, say what you want about nuns, at least they know their husband won't snore. She pinched Elizabeth's arm. No woman says no to marriage, Elizabeth. You won't either.
Calvin opened his eyes wide. You're saying no?
Yes.
Elizabeth.
Calvin, she said carefully, reaching across the table for his hands while taking in his deflated face. I thought we'd agreed on this. As a scientist yourself, I know you understand why marriage for me is out of the question. But his expression indicated no such understanding. Because I can't risk having my scientific contributions submerged beneath your name, she clarified.
Right, he said. Of course. Obviously. So it's a work conflict.
More of a societal conflict.
Well, that is awful, he shouted, causing any table that wasn't already watching to turn their full attention to the unhappy couple in the middle.
Calvin, she said, we've discussed this.
Yes, I know. You disapprove of the name change. But have I ever suggested that I wanted your name to change? He protested.
No. In fact, I expected you to keep your name. Which wasn't completely true. He'd assumed she'd take his name. Nevertheless, he said, but in any case, our future happiness should not depend on whether a handful of people might mistakenly call you Mrs. Evans. We'll correct those people.
This seemed like the wrong time to tell her he'd already added her name to the deed on his tiny bungalow. Elizabeth Evans. That's the name he'd given the county clerk. He made a mental note to call the clerk as soon as he was back in the lab.
Elizabeth shook her head. Our future happiness does not depend on whether or not we're married, Calvin. At least not to me. I'm fully committed to you. Marriage will not change that. As for who thinks what, it's not just a handful of people, it's society, particularly the Society of Scientific Research. Everything I do will suddenly be in your name, as if you'd done it. In fact, most people will assume you've done it simply because you're a man, but especially because you're Calvin Evans.
I don't want to be another Mileva Einstein or Esther Lederberg, Calvin. I refuse.
And if we took all the proper legal steps to ensure my name won't change, it will still change.
Everyone will call me Mrs. Calvin Evans. I will become Mrs. Calvin Evans. Every Christmas card, every bank statement, every notice from the Bureau of Internal Revenue will all come to Mr. and Mrs. Calvin Evans. Elizabeth Zott, as we know her, will cease to exist.
And being Mrs. Calvin Evans is absolutely the worst thing that could ever happen to you, he said, his face collapsed in misery.
I want to be Elizabeth Zott, she said. It's important to me.
They sat for a minute in uncomfortable silence. The hateful little blue box plopped between them like a bad referee in a tight match. Against her will, she found herself wondering what the ring looked like.
I really am sorry, she repeated.
Not a problem, he said stiffly. She looked away.
They're breaking up, Eddie hissed to the others. They're going straight down the tubes.
Shit, Frask thought. Zott's back on the market.
Except Calvin couldn't let it go. 30 seconds later, completely oblivious to the dozens of pairs of eyes resting upon them, he said in a voice far louder than he'd intended,
For the love of God, Elizabeth, it's just a name. It doesn't matter. You're you. That's what matters.
I wish that were true. It is true, he insisted. What's in a name? Nothing.
She looked up with sudden hope.
Nothing?
Well, in that case, what about changing your name?
To what?
To mine.
To Zott.
He looked at her in astonishment, then rolled his eyes. Very funny, he said.
Well, why not?
Her voice had an edge.
You already know why not.
Men don't do that. Anyway, there was my work, my reputation.
He hesitated.
What?
Say it.
Fine. I'm famous, Elizabeth. I can't just change my name.
Oh, she said. But if you weren't famous, then changing your name to mine would be fine. Is that what you mean?
Look, he said, grabbing the small blue box. I get it. I didn't make this tradition. It's just the way things are. When women get married, they take their husband's name, and 99.9% of them are fine with it.
And you have some sort of study to back up this assertion? She said.
What? That 99.9% of women are fine with it.
Well, no, but I've never heard any complaints before.
And the reason why you can't change your name is because you're famous, although 99.9% of men who aren't famous also happen to keep their names.
Again, he said, stuffing the small box in his pocket with such force that the fabric gave way at the corner.
I didn't create the tradition, and as I stated earlier, I was in full support of you keeping your name.
Was?
I don't want to marry you anymore.
Elizabeth sat back hard.
Game, set, match, crowed one of the geologists. Box is back in the pocket.
Calvin sat fuming. It had already been a tough day. Just that morning, he'd gotten a bunch of new crank letters, most from people purporting to be long-lost relatives. This wasn't unusual. Ever since he'd gotten a little famous, the flim-flam artist wrote en masse. A great uncle wanted Calvin to invest in his alchemy scheme. A sad mother claimed she was his biological mother and wanted to give him money. A so-called cousin needed cash. There were also two letters from women claiming they'd had his baby and he needed to pay up now. This was despite the fact that the only woman he'd ever slept with was Elizabeth Zott. Would this ever end?
Elizabeth, he implored as he raked his fingers through his hair. Please understand, I want us to be a family, a real family. It's important to me. Maybe because I lost my family, I don't know. What I do know is that ever since I met you, I felt there should be three of us. You, me, and a...
Elizabeth's eyes grew wide in horror.
Calvin, she said in alarm. I thought we agreed about that too. Well, we've never really talked about it.
No, we have, she pressed. We definitely have.
Well, just that once, he said, and it wasn't really a talk, not really.
I don't know how you can say that, she said, panicked. We absolutely agreed. No children. I can't believe you're talking like this. What's happened to you?
Right, but I was thinking we could...
I was clear.
I know, he interrupted, but I was thinking, you can't just change your mind on this one.
For Pete's sake, Elizabeth, he said, getting mad. If you'd just let me finish...
Go ahead, she snapped. Finish.
He looked at her frustrated.
I was only thinking that we could get a dog.
Relief flooded her face.
A dog? She said. A dog!
God damn it, Frass commented quietly as Calvin leaned over to kiss Elizabeth. The entire cafeteria instantly echoed her sentiment. From every direction, silverware fell to trays and resigned clatters. Chairs were kicked back and moody to feet. Napkins were wadded in dirty little balls. It was the noxious noise of profound jealousy, the kind that never results in a happy ending.
Chapter 7 6:30 Many people go to breeders to find a dog, and others to the pound, but sometimes, especially when it's really meant to be, the right dog finds you. It was a Saturday evening, about a month later, and Elizabeth had run down to the local deli to get something for dinner. As she left the store, her arms laden with a large salami and a bag of groceries, a mangy, smelly dog, hidden in the shadows of the alley, watched her walk by. Although the dog hadn't moved in 5 hours, he took one look at her, pulled himself up, and followed. Calvin happened to be at the window when he saw Elizabeth strolling toward the house, a dog following a respectful 5 paces behind, and as he watched her walk, a strange shudder swept through his body. Elizabeth thought, "You're going to change the world," he heard himself say. And the moment he said it, he knew it was true. She was going to do something so revolutionary, so necessary, that her name, despite a never-ending legion of naysayers, would be immortalized. And, as if to prove that point, today she had her first follower. "Who's your friend?" he called out to her, shaking off the odd feeling. "It's 6:30, she called back after glancing at her wrist. 6:30 was badly in need of a bath. Tall, gray, thin, and covered with barbed wire-like fur that made him look as if he'd barely survived electrocution, he stood very still as they shampooed him, his gaze fixed on Elizabeth. "I guess we should try to find his owner," Elizabeth said reluctantly. "I'm sure someone is worried to death." "This dog doesn't have an owner," Calvin assured her, and he was right. Later calls to the pound and listings in the newspaper's Lost and Found column turned up nothing. But even if it had, 6:30 had already made his intentions clear. To stay. In fact, stay was the first word he learned, although within weeks he also learned at least 5 others. That was what surprised Elizabeth most, 6:30's ability to learn. "Do you think he's unusual?" she asked Calvin more than once. "He seems to pick things up so quickly." "He's grateful," Calvin said. "He wants to please us." But Elizabeth was right. 6:30 had been trained to pick things up quickly. Bombs, specifically. Before he'd ended up in that alley, he'd been a canine bomb sniffer trainee at Camp Pendleton, a local Marine base. Unfortunately, he'd failed miserably. Not only could he never seem to sniff out the bomb in time, but he also had to endure the praise heaped upon the smug German shepherds who always did. He was eventually discharged, not honorably, by his angry handler, who drove him out to the highway and dumped him in the middle of nowhere. 2 weeks later, he found his way to that alley. 2 weeks and 5 hours later, he was being shampooed by Elizabeth, and she was calling him 6:30. "Are you sure we can take him to Hastings?" Elizabeth asked when Calvin loaded him in the car on Monday morning. "Sure, why not?" "Because I've never seen another dog at work. Besides, the labs aren't really that safe." "We'll keep a close eye on him," Calvin said. "It's not healthy for a dog to be left alone all day. He needs stimulation." This time, it was Calvin who was right. 6:30 had loved Camp Pendleton, partly because he was never alone, but mostly because it had given him something he'd never had before, purpose. But there'd been a problem. A bomb-sniffing dog had 2 choices. Find the bomb in time to allow disarmament, preferred, or throw himself on the bomb, making the ultimate sacrifice to save the unit, not preferred, although it did come with a posthumous medal. In training, the bombs were only ever fake, so if a dog did throw himself upon it, the most he might get was a noisy explosion followed by a huge burst of red paint. It was the noise. It scared 6:30 to death.
So each day when his handler commanded him to find it, he would immediately take off to the east, even though his nose had already informed him that the bomb was 50 yards to the west, poking his nose at various rocks while he waited for one of the other braver dogs to finally find the damn thing and receive his reward biscuit. Unless the dog was too late or too rough and the bomb exploded, then the dog only got a bath.
"You can't have a dog here, Dr. Evans," Miss Frask explained to Calvin. "We've gotten complaints."
"No one's complained to me," Calvin said, shrugging, even though he knew no one would dare. Frask backed off immediately. Within a few weeks, 630 made a full inventory of the Hastings campus, memorizing every floor, room, and exit like a firefighter preparing for catastrophe. When it came to Elizabeth Zott, he was on high alert. She'd suffered in her past, he could sense it, and he was determined she should never suffer again. It was the same for Elizabeth. She sensed that 630 had also suffered beyond the usual dog-left-by-the-roadside neglect, and she, too, felt the need to protect him. In fact, it was she who insisted that he sleep next to their bed, even though Calvin had suggested he might be better off in the kitchen. But Elizabeth won out, and he stayed, completely content, except for those times when Calvin and Elizabeth locked their limbs in a messy tangle, their clumsy movements punctuated with panting noises. Animals did this too, but with far more efficiency. Humans, 630 noticed, had a tendency to overcomplicate. If these encounters took place in the early morning, Elizabeth would rise soon after to go make breakfast. Although she'd originally agreed to cook dinner 5 nights a week in exchange for rent, she also added breakfast, then lunch. For Elizabeth, cooking wasn't some preordained feminine duty. As she'd told Calvin, cooking was chemistry. That's because cooking actually is chemistry. At 200 degrees centigrade for 35 minutes equals loss of 1 H2O per molecule. Sucrose, total 4 in 55 minutes, equals C24H36O18, she wrote in a notebook. So that's why the biscuit batter is off, she tapped her pencil against the countertop. Still too many water molecules. How's it going? Calvin called from the next room. Almost lost an atom in the isomerization process, she called back. I think I'll make something else. Are you watching Jack? She meant Jack LaLanne, the famous TV fitness guru, a self-made health aficionado who encouraged people to take better care of their bodies. She didn't really have to ask. She could hear Jack shouting, up, down, up, down, like a human yo-yo. I am, Calvin called back, breathless, as Jack demanded 10 more. Join us! I'm denaturing protein, she shouted. And now, running in place, urged Jack. Despite what Jack said, running in place was the one thing Calvin would not do. Instead, he did extra sit-ups while Jack ran in place in what very much looked like ballet slippers. Calvin didn't see the point of running indoors in ballet slippers. Instead, he always did his running outside in tennis shoes. This made him an early jogger, meaning that he jogged long before jogging was popular, long before it was even called jogging. Unfortunately, because others were unfamiliar with this jogging concept, the police precinct received a steady stream of calls regarding a barely clad man running through neighborhoods blowing short, hard bursts of air out between his purplish lips. Since Calvin always ran the same 4 or 5 routes, police soon became accustomed to these calls. That's not a criminal, they'd say. That's just Calvin. He doesn't like to run in place in ballet slippers. Elizabeth, he called again. Where's 630? Happy's on. Happy was Jack LaLanne's dog. Sometimes he was on the show, sometimes he wasn't. But when he was, 630 always left the room. Elizabeth sensed there was something about the German Shepherd that made 630 unhappy. He's with me, she called back. Holding an egg in the palm of her hand, she turned to him. Here's a tip, 630. Never crack eggs on the side of a bowl. It increases the chance of shell fragments. Better to bring a sharp, thin knife down on an egg as if you're cracking a whip. See? She said, as the egg's contents slipped into the bowl. 630 watched without blinking. Now I'm disrupting the egg's internal bonds in order to elongate the amino acid chain, she told him as she whisked, which will allow the freed atoms to bond with other similarly freed atoms. Then I'll reconstitute the mix into a loose whole, laying it on a surface of iron carbon alloy, where I'll subject it to precision heat, continually agitating the mix until it reaches a stage of near coagulation.
Lalanne is an animal, Calvin announced as he wandered into the kitchen, his t-shirt damp.
Agreed, Elizabeth said as she took the frying pan off the flame and placed the eggs on two plates. Because humans are animals, technically, although sometimes I think the animals we consider animals are far more advanced than the animals we are, but don't consider ourselves to be. She looked to 6:30 for confirmation, but even he couldn't parse that one.
Well, Jack gave me an idea, Calvin said, lowering his large frame into a chair. I think you're going to love it. I'm going to teach you to row.
Pass the sodium chloride.
You'll love it. We can row a pair together, maybe a double. We'll watch the sun rise on the water. Not really interested. We can start tomorrow.
Calvin still rowed 3 days a week, but only in a single. That wasn't uncommon for elite rowers. Once in a boat oared by teammates who seemed to know one another at a cellular level, they sometimes struggled to row with others. Elizabeth knew how much he missed his Cambridge boat. Still, she had no interest in rowing.
I don't want to. Besides, you row at 4:30 in the morning.
I row at 5 o'clock, he said, as if this made it so much more reasonable. I only leave the house at 4:30.
No.
Why?
No.
But why?
Because that's when I sleep.
Easily solved. We'll go to bed early.
No.
First, I'll introduce you to the rowing machine. We call it the Erg. They have some at the boathouse, but I'm going to build one for home use. Then we'll move to a boat, a shell. By April, we'll be skimming across the bay, watching the sun rise, our long strokes clicking along in perfect unison. But even as he said it, Calvin knew the rowing part wasn't possible. First, no one learns to row in a month. Most people, even with expert instruction, can't row well within a year or sometimes 3 years, or for many, ever. As for the skimming part, there is no skimming. To get to the point where rowing might resemble skimming, you've probably reached the Olympic level, and the look on your face as you fly down the race course is not one of calm satisfaction, but controlled agony. This is sometimes accompanied by a look of determination, usually one that indicates that right after this race is over, you plan to find a new sport. Still, once he'd hatched the idea, he loved it. Rowing a pair with Elizabeth, how glorious.
No, but why? Because women don't row.
But as soon as she'd said it, she regretted it.
Elizabeth Zott, he said, surprised. Are you actually saying women can't row?
That sealed it. The next morning, they left their bungalow in the dark. Calvin in his old t-shirt and sweatpants, Elizabeth in whatever she could find that looked remotely sporty. As they pulled up to the boathouse, both 6:30 and Elizabeth looked out the car window to see a few bodies on a slick dock doing calisthenics.
Shouldn't they be doing that inside? She asked. It's still dark.
On a morning like this? It was foggy. I thought you didn't like rain.
This isn't rain.
For at least the 40th time, Elizabeth found herself doubting this plan. We'll start off easy, Calvin said as he led her and 6:30 into the boathouse, a cavernous building that smelled of mildew and sweat. As they walked past rows of long wooden rowing shells layered to the ceiling like well-stacked toothpicks, Calvin nodded at a bedraggled-looking person who yawned and nodded back, conversation not yet possible. He stopped when he found what he was looking for, a rowing machine, the Erg, which had been tucked in a corner. He pulled it out, positioning it in the middle of the bay between the stacks of boats. First things first, he said, technique. He sat down, then started to pull, his breaths quickly becoming a series of short, torturous bursts that seemed neither easy nor fun. The trick is to keep your wrists flat, he huffed. Your knees down, your stomach muscles engaged, your... But whatever else he said was lost in his urgency to breathe, and within a few minutes he seemed to forget Elizabeth was even there. She slipped away, 6:30 at her side, and went to explore the boathouse, pausing in front of a rack holding a forest of oars so impossibly tall it looked as if giants played here. Off to its side sat a large trophy case. the early morning light just beginning to reveal its stash of silver cups and old rowing uniforms, each a testament to those who had proven faster or more efficient or more indomitable, or possibly all three. Brave people, according to Calvin, who'd shown the kind of focus that put them first over the finish. Alongside the uniforms were photographs of strapping young men with gargantuan oars. But there was one other person, too, a jockey-sized man who looked as serious as he was small, his mouth fixed in a firm, grim line. The coxswain, Calvin had told her, the one who told the rowers what to do and when to do it. Take up the rate, make a turn, challenge another boat, go faster. She liked that a diminutive person held the reins to eight wild horses, his voice, their command, his hands, their rudder, his encouragement, their fuel. She turned to watch as other rowers began to file in, each of them nodding in deference to Calvin as he continued to erg on the noisy machine, a few revealing a trace of envy as he took up the stroke rate with such obvious smoothness that even Elizabeth could recognize it as a sign of natural athleticism. "When are you going to row with us, Evans?" said one of them, clapping him on the shoulder. "We'll put that energy to good use." But if Calvin heard or felt anything, he didn't react. He kept his eyes forward, his body steady. So, she thought, he was a legend here too. It was obvious, not only in their deference, but in the obsequious manner in which they tried to work around him and his ridiculous position. Calvin had placed the rowing machine right in the middle of the boathouse floor. The coxswain, clearly annoyed, assessed the situation. "Hands on," he called to his eight rowers, calling them to jump into position on one side of their shell, their bodies braced to pick up the heavy boat. "Slide it out," he commanded. "Into, up to the shoulders." But it was obvious they weren't going anywhere, not with Calvin in the middle.
"Calvin," Elizabeth whispered urgently, scuttling up behind him, "you're in the way. You need to move." But he just kept erging.
"Jesus," said the coxswain, blowing air out between his lips. "This guy." He glanced at Elizabeth, then thumbed her sharply out of the way, taking up a crouched position directly behind Calvin's left ear.
"Attaboy, Cal," he growled. "Keep the length, you son of a bitch. We got 500 to go and you're not done yet. Oxford is coming up on starboard and they're starting to walk."
Elizabeth looked at him, astonished.
"Excuse me, but," she started. "I know this ain't all you got, Evans," he snarled, cutting her off. "Don't hold out on me, you fucking machine. In two, I'm calling for a power 20. In two, on my call, you're gonna put these Oxford sons of bitches to bed. You're gonna make these boys wish they were already dead. You're gonna kill them. Evans, wind it up, brother. We're at a 32 on our way to fucking 40 on my call. There's one. There's two. Take it up. Power 20, you motherfucker," he screamed, "right now."
Elizabeth didn't know what was more shocking, the little man's language or the intensity with which Calvin reacted to that language. Within moments of hearing the words, "you fucking machine" and "sons of bitches," Calvin's face took on a crazed look, usually not seen outside of low-budget zombie films. He pulled harder and faster, his exhale so loud he sounded like a runaway train. And yet the little man was not satisfied. He kept yelling at Calvin, demanding more and getting more as he counted down the strokes like an angry stopwatch. 20, 15, 10, 5. And then the count evaporated, and all that was left were two simple words that Elizabeth couldn't agree with more.
"Way enough," the coxswain said, upon which Calvin slumped heavily forward as if he'd been shot in the back.
"Calvin," Elizabeth cried, rushing to his side. "My God."
"He's fine," the coxswain said. "Aren't you, Cal? Now move this fucking machine out of our fucking way."
And Calvin nodded, sucking in oxygen.
"Sure. A thing, Sam," he panted between gulps of air. "And thanks, but first I'd like you to meet Elizabeth Zott, my new pair, partner."
Immediately, Elizabeth felt all eyes in the boathouse upon her.
"A pair? With Evans?" one of the rowers said, his eyes wide. "What'd you do? Win a gold medal in the Olympics?"
"What?
You've rowed on a women's team then?" the coxswain asked, taking interest.
Well, no, I've never really... And then she stopped. There are women's teams?
She's learning, Calvin explained as he began to catch his breath. But she already has what it takes. He inhaled deeply.
Then he got off the machine and started to drag it out of the way.
By summer, we'll be wiping the bay with all of you.
Elizabeth wasn't sure what that meant exactly. Wiping the bay? He didn't actually mean compete, did he? What happened to watching the sunrise?
Well, she said quietly, turning toward the coxswain as Calvin went to towel off. I'm not sure this is really my...
It is, the coxswain interrupted before she could finish. Evans would never ask anyone to be in a boat with him if they couldn't hold their own. And then he closed one eye and squinted.
Yeah, I see it too.
What? She said, surprised. But he'd already turned away, barking out orders for the boat to be walked down to the dock.
1 foot in, she heard him yell, and down.
And within moments, the boat disappeared into a thick fog, the men's faces oddly eager, despite the first fat drops of a cold rain, warning of the discomfort that was yet to come. Chapter 8. Overreaching. The first day on the water, she and Calvin flipped the pair and fell in the water. Second day, flipped. Third day, flipped.
What am I doing wrong? She gasped, her teeth chattering as they pushed the long, thin shell toward the dock.
She'd neglected to tell Calvin one little fact about herself. She couldn't swim.
Everything, he sighed.
As I've mentioned before, he said 10 minutes later as he pointed at the rowing machine, indicating that despite her wet clothes, she should sit. Rowing requires perfect technique. While she adjusted the foot stretchers, he explained that rowers usually erged when the water was too rough, or they had to be timed, or when the coach was in a really bad mood. And when done right, especially during a fitness test, there was vomiting. Then he mentioned that erging had a way of making the worst day in the water seem pretty good. And yet, that is exactly what they continued to have, the worst of days. The very next morning they were back in the water, and it was all because Calvin continued to omit one simple truth. The pair is the hardest boat to row. It's like trying to learn to fly by starting out in a B-52. But what choice did he have? He knew the men weren't going to let her row with them in a bigger boat, like an 8. Besides being female, her lack of experience meant she'd ruin the row. Worse, she'd probably catch a crab and crack a few ribs. He hadn't mentioned crabs yet, for obvious reasons. They righted the boat and crawled back in.
The problem is that you're not patient enough up the slide. You need to slow the hell down, Elizabeth.
I'm going slow.
No, you're rushing. It's one of the worst mistakes a rower can make. Every time you rush the slide, you know what happens? God kills a kitten.
Oh, for God's sake, Calvin.
And your catch is too slow. The object is to go fast, remember?
Well, that certainly clears things up, she snapped from the stern.
Go slow to go fast.
He clapped her on the shoulder as if she was finally getting it.
Exactly.
Shivering, she tightened her grip on the oar.
What a stupid sport.
For the next 30 minutes, she tried to heed his contradictory commands.
Raise your hands. No, lower them. Lean out. God, not that far. Jesus, you're slouching. You're skying. You're rushing. You're late. You're early.
Until the boat itself seemed sick of the whole thing and pitched them back into the water.
Maybe this is a bad idea, Calvin said as they marched back to the boathouse, the heavy rowing shell biting into their sodden shoulders.
What's my main issue? She said, bracing herself for the worst as they lowered the boat into the rack. Calvin had always insisted that rowing required the highest level of teamwork, a problem since, according to her boss, she also wasn't a team player.
Just tell me. Don't hold back.
Physics, Calvin said.
Physics, she said, relieved. Oh, thank God.
I get it, she said, skimming a physics textbook later that day at work. Rowing is a simple matter of kinetic energy versus boat drag and center of mass. She jotted down a few formulas.
And gravity, she added, and buoyancy ratio, speed, balance, gearing, oar length, blade type.
The more she read, the more she wrote. The nuances of rowing slowly revealing themselves in complicated algorithms.
Oh, for heaven's sake, she said, sitting back. Rowing isn't that hard.
Jesus, Calvin exclaimed 2 days later as their boat sped unimpeded through the water. Who are you?
She said nothing, replaying the formulas in her head. As they passed a men's eight sitting at rest, every rower turned to watch them go by.
Did you see that? The coxswain shouted angrily at his crew. Did you see how she gets length without overreaching?
And yet, about a month later, her boss, Dr. Donati, accused her of exactly that.
You're overreaching, Miss Zott, he said,
pausing to squeeze the top of her shoulder.
Abiogenesis is more of a PhD university, this topic is so boring no one cares sort of thing, and don't take this the wrong way, but it exceeds your intellectual grasp.
And exactly what way am I supposed to take that? She shrugged his hand off.
What happened here? He said, ignoring her tone as he took her bandaged fingers in his hand. If you're struggling with the lab equipment, you know you can ask one of the fellas to help you.
I'm learning to row, she said, snatching her fingers back. Despite her recent gains, the next several rows had been complete failures.
Rowing, huh? Donati said, rolling his eyes. Evans.
Donati had been a rower too, and at Harvard no less, where he'd had the incredible misfortune to row just once against Evans and his precious Cambridge boat at the fucking Henley. Their catastrophic loss, 7 boat lengths, witnessed only by a handful of people who'd managed to glimpse it over a sea of impossibly big hats, was carefully blamed on some fish and chips they'd ingested the night before instead of the tonnage of beer that had washed it down. In other words, they were all still drunk at the start. After the race, their coach had told them to go over and congratulate the la-di-da Cambridge crew. That's when Donati had first learned one of the Cambridge boys was an American who held some sort of grudge against Harvard. As he shook Evans' hand, Donati managed, good row. But instead of responding in kind, Evans said, Jesus, are you drunk? Donati took an instant dislike to him. A dislike that tripled when he found out that Evans was not only studying chemistry as he was, but he was that Evans, Calvin Evans, the guy who'd already made a major mark in the chemistry world. Was it any surprise that years later, when Evans accepted the incredibly insulting Hastings offer Donati himself had crafted, Donati wasn't overly enthusiastic? First, Evans didn't remember him. Rude. Second, Evans appeared to have maintained his fitness. Annoying. Third, Evans told Chemistry Today that he took the position not based on Hastings' sterling reputation, but because he liked the fucking weather. Seriously, the man was an asshole. However, there was one consolation. He, Donati, was director of chemistry, and not just because his father played golf with the CEO, or because he happened to be the man's godson, and certainly not because he'd married the man's daughter. Bottom line, the great Evans would be reporting to him. To enforce that pecking order, he called a meeting with the blowhard, then purposely showed up 20 minutes late. Unfortunately, to an empty conference room, because Evans hadn't shown up at all. Sorry, Dino, Evans later informed him. I really don't like meetings. It's Donati. And now, Elizabeth Zott. He didn't like Zott. She was pushy, smart, opinionated. Worse, she had terrible taste in men. Unlike so many others, though, he did not find Zott attractive. He glanced down at a silver-framed photograph of his family, 3 big-eared boys bracketed by the sharp-beaked Edith and himself. He and Edith were a team the way couples were meant to be a team, not by sharing hobbies like rowing, for fuck's sake, but in the way their sex is deemed socially and physically appropriate. He brought home the bacon, she pumped out the babies. It was a normal, productive, God-approved marriage. Did he sleep with other women? What a question. Didn't everyone? My underlying hypothesis, Zott was saying.
Underlying hypothesis, his ass. This was the other thing he hated about Zott. She was tireless, stiff, didn't know when to quit. Standard rower attributes, now that he thought about it. He hadn't rowed in years. Was there really a women's team in town? Obviously, she couldn't possibly be rowing with Evans. An elite rower like Evans would never deign to get in a boat with a novice, even if they were sleeping together. Scratch that. Especially if they were sleeping together. Evans probably signed her up for some beginner crew, and Zot, wanting to prove that she could hold her own, per usual, went along with it. He shuddered at the thought of a bunch of struggling rowers, their blades hitting the water like out-of-control spatulas.
"I'm determined to see this through, Dr. Donati," Zot asserted.
Yes, yes, there it was. Women like her always use the word determined. Well, he was determined, too. Just last night, he'd come up with a new way to deal with Zot. He was going to steal her away from Evans. What better way to fix the big man's wagon? Then, once he'd made the Evans-Zot romance a crash scene with no survivors, he'd dump her and return to his once again pregnant housewife and impossibly loud children, no harm done. His plan was simple. First, attack Zot's self-esteem. Women were so easily crushed. "Like I said," Donati emphasized as he stood, sucking in his gut as he shooed her toward the door. "You're just not smart enough." Elizabeth stalked down the hallway, her heels hitting the tile in a dangerous staccato. She tried to calm herself by taking a deep breath in, but it came rushing back out at hurricane speed. Stopping abruptly, she slammed her fist against the wall, then took a moment to review her options. Replead case, quit, set fire to the building. She didn't want to admit it, but his words were like fresh fuel to her ever-growing pyre of self-doubt. She had neither the education nor the experience of the others. She not only lacked their credentials, but their papers, peer support, financial backing, and awards. And yet she knew she was onto something. Some people were born to things. She was one of those people. She pressed her hand on her forehead as if that might keep her head from exploding. "Miss Zot? Excuse me, Miss Zot?" The voice seemed to come from out of nowhere. "Miss Zot." From just around the next corner peeked a thin-haired man with a sheaf of papers. It was Dr. Borovitz, a lab mate who often sought her help, as most of the others did, when no one else was looking. "I was wondering if you could take a look at this," he said in a low voice as he motioned her off to the side, his voice rutted with anxiety. "My latest test results." He thrust a sheet of paper into her hands. "I'd call this a breakthrough, wouldn't you?" His hands trembled. "Something new?" He wore his normal expression, frightened, as if he'd just seen a ghost. It was a mystery to most how Dr. Borovitz had ever gotten a PhD in chemistry, much less a job at Hastings. He often seemed just as mystified. "Do you think your young man might be interested in this?" Borovitz asked. "Maybe you could show it to him. Is that where you were headed, his lab? Maybe I could tag along." He reached out, grasping her forearm as if she were a life buoy, something he could cling to until the big rescue ship in the form of Calvin Evans pulled up. Elizabeth carefully pulled the papers from his grip. Despite his neediness, she liked Borovitz. He was polite, professional, and they had something in common. They were both in the wrong place at the wrong time, albeit for entirely different reasons. "The thing is, Dr. Borovitz," she said, trying to put aside her own troubles as she studied his work, "this is macromolecule with repeating units linked by amide bonds." "Right, right. In other words, it's a polyamide." His face fell. Even he knew polyamides had been around forever. I think you might be mistaken," he said. "Look again." "It's not a bad finding," she said gently. "It's just that it's already been proven." He shook his head in defeat. "So I shouldn't show this to Donati."
You've basically rediscovered nylon."
"Really?" he said, looking down at his results. "Darn." His head submerged. An uncomfortable silence followed. Then he glanced at his watch as if there might be an answer there. "What's all this?" he finally said, pointing to her bandaged fingers. "Oh, I'm a rower, or trying to be." "Are you any good?" "No." "Then why are you doing it?" "I'm not sure." He shook his head. "Boy, do I get that." "How's your project going?" Calvin asked Elizabeth a few weeks later as they sat together at lunch. He took a bite of his turkey sandwich, chewing vigorously to disguise the fact that he already knew. Everybody knew.
"Fine," she said.
"No problems?"
"None,"
she sipped her water. "You know, if you ever need my help..."
"I don't need your help."
Calvin sighed, frustrated. It was a form of naivety, he thought. the way she continued to believe that all it took to get through life was grit. Sure, grit was critical, but it also took luck, and if luck wasn't available, then help. Everyone needed help. But maybe because she'd never been offered any, she refused to believe in it. How many times had she asserted that if she did her best would win? He'd lost count. And this was despite significant evidence to the contrary, especially at Hastings. As he finished their lunch, she barely touched hers, he promised himself he would not intervene on her behalf. It was important to respect her wishes. She wanted to handle this on her own. He would not get involved.
"What's your problem, Donati?" he roared approximately 10 minutes later as he burst into his boss's office. "Is it an origin of life issue? Pressure from the religious community? Abiogenesis is just more proof that there actually is no God, and you're worried this might not play well in Kansas? Is that why you're canceling Zod's project? And you dare to call yourself a scientist?"
"Cal," Donati had said, his arms stretched casually behind his head. "As much as I love our little chats, I'm kind of busy right now."
"Because the only other viable explanation," Calvin accused, shoving his hands in the front pockets of his voluminous khakis, "is that you don't understand her work."
Donati rolled his eyes as a puff of stale air escaped his lips. Why were brilliant people so dumb? If Evans had any brains at all, he'd accuse him of attempting to horn in on his good-looking girlfriend.
"Actually, Cal," Donati said, stubbing out a cigarette, "I was trying to give her career a little boost, giving her a chance to work with me directly on a very important project, help her grow in other areas."
There, Donati thought. Grow in other areas. How obvious could he be? But Calvin started in on her latest test results as if they were still talking about work. The guy was clueless.
"I get offers every week," Calvin threatened. "Hastings isn't the only place I can conduct my research."
This again. How many times had Donati heard it? Sure, Evans was a hot ticket in the research world, and yes, much of their funding was based on his mere presence. But that was only because funders erroneously believed that Evans' name attracted other big brain talent. Hadn't happened. Anyway, he didn't want Evans to leave. He only wanted Evans to fail, to become so unhinged by love lost that he self-destructed, ruining his reputation and tanking all research opportunities going forward. Once that happened, then he could leave.
"Like I said," Donati replied in a measured voice, "I was only trying to give Miss Zod a chance for personal growth. I'm trying to help her career."
"She can take care of her own career," Donati laughed.
"Really? And yet here you are."
But what Donati didn't tell Calvin was that a huge fly had recently landed in his get rid of Evans via Zod ointment. A donor with impossibly deep pockets. The man had appeared out of the blue 2 days ago with a blank check and an insistence to fund, of all things, abiogenesis. Donati mounted a polite argument. "What about lipid metabolism," he suggested, "or cell division?" But the man insisted, "Abiogenesis or nothing." So Donati had no choice. He put Zot back on her ridiculous mission to Mars. Truth was, he wasn't making much headway with her anyway. She'd steadily refused to yield to his repeated, "You're not smart," put-downs. No matter how many times he said it, she hadn't once responded in the proper fashion. Where was the low self-esteem? Where were the tears? If she wasn't restating her boring case for abiogenesis in a professional way, then she was saying, "Touch me again and live to regret it." What the hell did Evan see in this woman? He could keep her. He'd have to find some other way to fix the big man's wagon.
"Calvin," Elizabeth said, rushing into his lab later that afternoon, "I have great news. I've been keeping something from you, and I apologize, but it was only because I didn't want you to get involved. Donati canceled my project a few weeks back, and I've been fighting to get it back. Today, that fight paid off. He reversed his decision, said he'd reviewed my work and decided it was too important not to move forward."
Calvin smiled broadly in what he hoped was the appropriate expression of surprise. He'd left Donati's office less than an hour ago.
"Wait, really?" he said, clapping her on the back. "He tried to cancel abiogenesis? Well, that must have been a mistake from the start."
I'm sorry I didn't tell you about it. I wanted to handle it on my own, and now I'm glad I did. I feel like it's a real vote of confidence in my work, in me, definitely.
She looked at him more closely, then took a step back.
I did get this on my own. You had nothing to do with it. First time I've heard about it. You never talked to Donati, she pressed. You never got involved. I swear, he lied.
After she left, Calvin clasped his hands together in a silent fit of glee and flipped on the hi-fi, dropping the needle on sunny side of the street. For a second time, he'd saved the person he loved the most, and the best part was, she didn't know. He grabbed a stool, opened a notebook, and began to write. He'd been keeping journals since age 7 or so, jotting down the facts and fears of his life between lines of chemical equations. Even today, his lab was full of those nearly illegible notebooks. It was one of the reasons everyone assumed he was getting a lot done. Volume.
Your handwriting is hard to read here, Elizabeth had noted on several occasions. What does that say?
She'd pointed to an RNA-related theory he'd been toying with for months.
A hypothesis about enzymatic adaptation, he answered. And this, she pointed farther down the page, something he'd written about her.
More of the same, he said, tossing the notebook aside.
It wasn't that he was writing anything terrible about her, just the opposite. Rather, it was more that he couldn't risk having her discover that he was obsessed with the notion that she might die. He'd long ago decided that he was a jinx, and he had solid proof. Every person he'd ever loved had died, always in a freak accident. The only way to put an end to this deadly pattern was to put an end to love, and he had. But then he'd met Elizabeth, and without meaning to, had stupidly and selfishly gone on to love again. Now here she was, standing directly in line of his jinx fire. As a chemist, he realized his fixation